Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
In Bangladesh, the country's longtime leader, ousted from power, is now facing charges of crimes against humanity after a violent crackdown over the summer that killed hundreds of demonstrators.
People really, really want accountability and justice for this terrible catastrophe that happened in Bangladesh.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will also hear about the Olympic snowboarder from Canada who's wanted by the FBI and an effort off the coast of England to help reverse the impact of overfishing.
Maternity tank, yeah.
Maternity.
Yeah, so it's where all the pregnant mums go, basically. And our job is to collect the hatchlings every day.
Also, what it's like along Korea's demilitarized zone.
Paradoxically, up near the DMZ where I walk, few people seem to be concerned about it. Maybe they've just grown used to it and grown jaded by it.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. She ruled over Bangladesh for more than 20 years, but ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina now faces charges of crimes against humanity. A special court in Bangladesh issued an arrest warrant for Hasina this week, along with 45 others, including some of her close aides and former government ministers.
Hasina fled to India in August after a deadly crackdown against student-led demonstrations in Bangladesh. The protests began over the summer and were sparked by government hiring quotas. In mid-July, we spoke with Samina Luthfa from the University of Dhaka.
Today, the crackdown was specifically brutal because it was younger children. So there were high schoolers and students from private universities. It's no longer about the quota reforms. It is about against the violence.
By the time Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina left the country in August, authorities reported several hundred people were dead. Naomi Hossein is a professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London.
I don't think it's a surprise at all. I think the evidence is fairly clear that there was orders from her government to suppress the protests back in July and August. And I think those orders were carried out. And I think now the death toll is somewhere over 1,000, and thousands of people are injured and maimed and, of course, traumatized too. So not a surprise.
What do people in Bangladesh want to see happen with Hasina?
People really, really want accountability and justice for this terrible catastrophe that happened in Bangladesh. I think people were really horrified and absolutely shocked when the firing started, when the shooting started and the killing started in July and August. I think everyone knew that Sheikh Hasina was increasingly authoritarian in her rule, in her way of governing Bangladesh. But even then, the extent of the violence was really quite inconceivable, at least to begin with. So I think there is a very, very strong demand in Bangladesh for justice and accountability.
Bangladesh is now being led by Nobel Prize winning economist Muhammad Yunus. He is then, you know, overseeing this court. Is this seen at all as politically motivated? Because I know that Hasina and Yunus were political rivals for many years. And at one point, Yunus faced serious charges for money laundering that supporters say were politically motivated.
I think that there are some quarters in which it will be seen as politicized. And certainly, it's not only Professor Yunus, other members of the interim government also faced oppression, faced jail, faced all sorts of harassment over the years. But then not very many people who spoke up for democracy, who were independent-minded, did not face that sort of oppression. So there's not that many people left, to be honest, in Bangladesh who would not have some kind of claim. But I think that the crimes were pretty plain. I think we all saw it in the media, where many, many people were actually there witnessing these events. So I don't think in that sense that it will be seen as political.
So you said that the interim government, which is being headed up by Mohamed Yunus, a well-known economist there, they do have a lot of popular support. What is at the top of that government's agenda at the moment?
So the law and order situation is still not restored to what it was. So that's a really big priority for this government. Another really big priority is the cost of living crisis, which has only really been worsened by these months of unrest and the fact that it's had a lot of economic disruption. I think that the interim government has been handling that reasonably well. I think they're trying to put in place all sorts of mechanisms to help people who are finding it hard to, you know, meet their basic needs. They set up another 4 new commissions. Only today we heard on things like women's rights, health, the media, and so on. They have a huge agenda. And most of all, of course, they have to manage to somehow restore a sufficient state of democracy in Bangladesh that free and fair elections can be held. And they're under a considerable amount of pressure from the other, from the non-Awami League political parties, the BNP and the Jamaat Islami, to hold them fast.
So you mentioned long term, the biggest tasks for the interim government are addressing the cost of living crisis, so economic issues, and then also restoring democracy. Is the United States offering any support on either of those fronts?
I think the U.S. is, as far as I know, supportive, certainly of democratic reforms. Energy deals were cut while Sheikh Hasina was in power. We were hearing that billions of dollars have been looted. I understand that the Bangladesh government is reaching out to governments around the world, including the U.S. and the U.K., to help recover those assets and to prevent further money laundering. But these are very, very difficult things to do.
Naomi, I think I'm wondering if your personal relationship to the country has been coloring how you see this pivotal moment in its history.
I've been in London the whole time this crisis was going on, but you know that was quite useful in some ways because there was a time when people in Bangladesh could not speak freely, could not tweet freely, could not go on the TV and talk about what's going on in Bangladesh, and I was able to do those things. All my academic friends and my civil society friends are, you know, doing all kinds of things to produce inputs, guide, and you know, give information and evidence that will be helpful. But it's very hard to run a country that has had its state completely sucked into the agenda of a political party for so many years, where the army, the police, all of the institutions have become fused with the ruling party. So prizing those apart again, separating the state from the politics is such a huge challenge. So I think people are quite rightly, you know, a mix of optimism and worry, I think I'd say.
Naomi Hossein is a global research professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies. She joined us from London.
In the coastal county of Cornwall in southwest England, lobster fishing is hugely important to the local culture. It's big business, too, and that's because of an effort going back 25 years. Jamie Fullerton reports from Cornwall's National Lobster Hatchery.
In Padstow Harbour, a bearded busker on a bench plays guitar. Seniors sketch the boats resting on the calm sea. Tourists enjoy lobster sandwiches. A few steps from the harbour is the National Lobster Hatchery and its head of production, Ben Marshall.
Here we are at our brood tank, which is where the whole process starts here in the hatchery. So
the National Lobster Hatchery was founded in the year 2000 and is responsible for hatching, then releasing up to 50,000 baby European lobsters each year. It's helping to keep the species sustainable for fishing.
Yeah, maternity tank, yeah.
Maternity
tank. Yeah, so it's where all the pregnant mums go, basically. And our job is to collect the hatchlings every day.
Local fishermen bring adult female lobsters laden with tiny eggs, known as buried hens, to Marshall at the hatchery.
I'll grab one of these, there we go. So here we go. So this is one of the mothers that is not quite ready yet, but when those eggs start to turn red, you can see under there are thousands of them.
After the baby lobsters hatch, They are sucked into buckets of seawater. I watch the tiny, shrimp-like lobsters swim around the buckets. They shed their skin a few times in the 2 weeks they're in these buckets. They're fed tiny crustaceans called copepods. And, Marshall tells me, they fight.
But all the adult lobsters have got their claws taped up. And that's for their benefit as well as ours. They will destroy each other. And it's
later,
the baby lobsters
are moved to compartments in underwater trays, where they grow to about 2 centimetres in length over a few more weeks. They are then released into the sea, close to land, where they can settle among rocks and seaweed. So, why is a lobster hatchery needed in Cornwall? Marshall tells me that nearly 25 years ago, the hatchery was founded by Eddie Derryman, who was the Sea Fisheries Officer for Cornwall. Derryman had learned that in Scandinavia, the lobster population had collapsed due to fishing.
Eddie saw that and was like, well, we don't want that in Cornwall because lobsters sustain a lot of people.
Cornwall has 40 harbours. A report released this year showed that in 2021, the seafood sector brought in more than $230 million to the Cornish economy.
I mean, even in modern times, a lot of the fishermen that are going out there fishing for shellfish have, you know, the lobster is what they want to see in their pot because it's worth more money.
It's particularly important to prevent lobster levels from dipping now because these days, fishermen have to return a lot of the lobsters they catch. Since 2017, it's been illegal to keep female lobsters with eggs, the buried hens. For the hatchery, it's a game of percentages. Only a small amount of the lobsters born in the hatchery survive long enough to get released, partly due to their tendency to eat each other.
People are sometimes shocked that it's about 10 to 15% of what hatches is released. But that is, we have to remember that naturally, that is 0.005%. So 10% is a huge increase, about 1,000 times more than natural.
Guys, we're going to show you the process of these female lobsters we've had today. So as you can see, this big female, she's got no eggs. I'm capable of keeping that.
Dan Gilbert is a fisherman, like his father. He's based in Newquay Harbour, down the coast from Padstow. Gilbert skippers a small boat and is big on TikTok under the profile name The Cornish Fisherman.
So we're going to give her a snacky snack if she'll take it.
Some fishermen, including Gilbert, have a special licence that allows them to land female lobsters with eggs if they give them to the hatchery. Gilbert can't give all the buried hens he catches to the hatchery, so he returns many to sea. Among the seagulls and nets in Newquay Harbour, I ask Gilbert if he thinks the lobster hatchery makes a difference to his work.
It's having a massive effect. And like, I go back to me being on TikTok, I have hundreds, 100,000 people watch me a day on a live stream. And they can see like how many small lobsters I'm throwing back daily. It's probably over 100 of small baby lobsters. So it's definitely working. We rely on lobsters for our livelihood. We're a shellfish port, and it's mainly what I target, mainly. I thrive on catching lobsters. You see a lobster pot, lobster come up in a pot, it's just pure excitement. So they are a massive thing for this harbour.
Back in Padstow, tourists continue to queue for the $17 lobster sandwiches. In gift stores, children nag their parents for plastic lobster toys. Lobsters are clearly helping to sustain multiple economies in this part of the world. And the National Lobster Hatchery is clearly helping to keep it that way. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Cornwall.
New car ads promise a lot, like all those high-tech features that will, they say, make driving positively relaxing.
Find your calm in a Ford Explorer SUV.
And now, the reality. A new study from the UK's largest independent road safety organization says road rage is a fact of modern life. 63% of respondents said they get worked up while driving, and more than 4 out of 5 admitted to tailgating in anger.
which can cause car crashes.
The prevalence of dashboard cameras means we can actually see more instances of road rage than ever. Like in this video, where an angry young woman jumps on the hood of a car in a British parking lot while the driver's 8-month-old daughter is in the back seat.
Here in the U.S., things are not any better. A AAA survey from a handful of years ago finds that 80% of U.S. drivers surveyed experienced road rage or significant anger while driving. Stay safe out there, everyone. Deep breaths.
You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Lack of diversity in the arts has been getting more and more attention, from entertainment awards like the Oscars to whose work gets shown in museums.
It's an issue in the publishing industry, too. Novelist Hong Kong just became the first South Korean author and first Asian woman to win a Nobel Prize in literature. Meanwhile, some Asian American authors say the big publishing houses in the U.S. tend to pigeonhole their stories.
An energetic upstart is trying to change that. The World's Marco Werman brings us the story.
Writer Ahn Soon Choi had written a compelling manuscript for a book about the high-profile coroner of Los Angeles County, Thomas Noguchi.
Apparently attempted to get on to the dinghy, slipped and fell in the water, unable to return to the dinghy or the boat. And later, the body was found about a mile away.
That's Thomas Noguchi in 1981 announcing the death of actress Natalie Wood. He wasn't a scintillating speaker, but Ahn Soon Choi knew it was his story that sparks. Japanese by birth, moved to the U.S. after medical school, and became the coroner of the stars, performing autopsies on the bodies of Marilyn Monroe, Robert F. Kennedy, many other well-known cases. The story had everything, so Choi thought one of the big publishers in New York would snap up her book, capturing how this obscure civil servant became a star just by doing his job.
I mean, we're at a moment where the coroner of L.A. County can become a celebrity in his own right. If it wasn't for Thomas Noguchi, we would not have any of the CSI franchise. Like, we would not have this kind of thriving interest in death investigation. And I also think that without Thomas Noguchi, you wouldn't have sort of LA true crime in many ways.
Choi was also intrigued by an unexpected chapter in Noguchi's story. Twice he was fired from his post in Los Angeles County amid controversy, and both times his exit mobilized marginalized communities in his defense.
Mexican-Americans, African-Americans, and Asian-Americans unite in the late 60s to champion Noguchi's reinstatement after he is suspended and fired. And this story, you know, tells you a lot about the relationships of communities of color that also don't get told very often.
But that's not what publishers told her interested them.
It was this sense that they just didn't get the project at all, that I wanted to tell Thomas Noguchi's story and not Marilyn Monroe's story or, you know, Charles Manson's story, but, you know, really to talk about these events through Thomas Noguchi.
So Ahn Soon Choi took a different route. She went to a new, smaller house, Third State Books in San Francisco.
We're the first, as far as we know, general interest publisher exclusively dedicated to AAPI authors and stories.
That's Stephanie Lim, co-founder and CEO of Third State Books. The idea for a bespoke press for AAPI writers emerged after she and co-founder Charles Lim realized why there seemed to be a lack of interest in such stories among gatekeepers at the so-called Big Five: Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster.
There's actually no single editor even within the Big Five who is dedicated exclusively to acquiring works by these authors. What you end up with is a system where AAPI and other writers of color plugging into a system where oftentimes every touch point at every level is with a person that may not have the framework for understanding their experience.
And why is there that deficit of editors? Third State co-founder Charles Kim offers what he thinks is one big reason.
It is a very opaque industry. So for communities that have historically had low engagement with the publishing industry, they simply don't know that these jobs exist. My mom pushed me to be a lawyer. And when I went into publishing, she kind of understood what was happening, but she just didn't know anyone. And I, growing up, never met anyone who actually worked in publishing that was Asian American. So there's a barrier to entry. So it becomes this sort of vicious cycle.
Simon & Schuster is one of the big five where progress is being made. I got in touch with CEO Jonathan Karp and put the question to him. Does the publishing industry have a diversity problem? And if it does, how would you describe it?
I think the publishing industry needs to be much better at bringing people from different backgrounds into the business. Absolutely. And it has been a perennial problem. It's been an issue for as long as people have worked in publishing. It's been too white for too long.
Karp explained that Simon & Schuster has made efforts to address what's happening under its own roof. He told me they've gone into universities and marginalized communities to recruit promising editors. They've created internships and entry-level programs for positions in publishing. It has led, he says, to a situation now where
Simon & Schuster's workforce does represent the demography of the general population. So we line up pretty well with the representation of Black people in the population and Asian American people in the population. We're a little bit below where we should be on the Latinx population. And we're trying to do better there. And we actually recently started an imprint for Latinx readers. It's called the Primero Sueño.
Not everyone thinks demographics by the numbers will change the landscape for Asian American stories in publishing or beyond. Author Viet Thanh Nguyen, for example, has written extensively about the need to remedy what he calls narrative scarcity, a situation where a handful of big breakout books, like The Joy Luck Club, are expected to represent large, diverse communities of people hungry to finally see themselves and their stories. It's an impossible order for any one book to fill. Third State Books could help resolve some of that scarcity, but it does not have the staff nor the marketing budget of a Simon & Schuster or any of the Big Five. What it does have is a mission. CEO Stephanie Lim again.
You know, right now we're a startup, so we have to be really scrappy. We have to inspire people to tell their stories authentically and not feel burdened by what they think the system expects of them.
If more efforts had been undertaken earlier by the Big Five to respond favorably to stories like what Ansoon Choi wrote with her Thomas Noguchi book, things might have turned out differently for her. She's delighted, though, that Third State Books has given her a home for L.A. coroner Thomas Noguchi and Death in Hollywood.
Asian Americans deserve true crime, too. You know, that to have like a full range of things that represent Asian America, you know, we deserve true crime, we deserve romance, we deserve horror, we deserve kid books, like we deserve, you know, the full spectrum of the things that are available to other folks.
Ansoon Choi's book, out in December, is one of 7 volumes being published by Third State Books this year. They're aiming to release 10 more in 2025. For the world, I'm Marco Werman.
On the Korean Peninsula, the leaders of North and South Korea are acting increasingly antagonistic. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is telling troops in his country to treat South Korea as a hostile foreign enemy. That is according to state media. South Korea had no immediate response to Kim's remarks. But the split between the two countries looks different through the eyes of regular folks living near the border. We'll hear that perspective still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. New Zealand is heading to the Women's T20 World Cup cricket final, but that is not the real shocker heading into the championship game.
You kind of go, hang on a minute, what's happening here? And it was the kind of ease with which they did it as well. You just felt like South Africa were in control and Australia didn't quite know where to look or where to go.
The big weekend coming up in women's cricket ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. In El Salvador, five environmental activists facing charges of murder were acquitted in court today. The Santa Marta Five, as they're known, were part of a movement that brought an end to the mining industry in El Salvador, and many believe the murder charges were politically motivated. Jorge Cuellar teaches Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College. He's been following the trial. He shared his reaction to today's verdict.
So the Santa Marta Five are five men. Their names are Miguel Angel Gámez, Alejandro Lainez García, Pedro Antonio Rivas Lainez, Antonio Pacheco, and Saul Agustin Rivas Ortega. And these five men, community leaders, environmental defenders, were being accused of a crime committed in 1989 in the framework of the Salvadoran Civil War that lasted from 1980 to 1992.
And did the court say anything when it acquitted the five today about why they were acquitted?
They said that they were acquitted because there's absolutely no evidence to pursue this case.
So this case against these five was brought by the government of Nayib Bukele, President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador. Now that they've been acquitted, what do you expect the government to do?
So what I expect the government to do at this point is to apologize to the Santa Marta Five, the Santa Marta community, who has dealt with a lot of the damage and hurt and trauma and intimidation at the hands of the state in order to pursue this trial. And the other being that the government takes seriously what these social movements are saying. What Santa Marta is have been mobilized around is the defense of a dignified life and the environment.
Now, the backdrop to this whole case is that these five environmentalists, they were also really key in getting the mining industry shut down in El Salvador. That was in 2005 and then finally in 2017. And so the backstory is that Bukele wants to reopen the mining industry. I mean, how important is mining to El Salvador's economy?
From 2005 to 2017, the mining sector, while it was productive and, had profits, and these are transnational corporations that are, operating in multiple different countries. But in El Salvador, it was the mining of gold. And gold, as you know, from 2017, at least until now, has experienced an incredible spike in value. And so there's even more hunger by the mining sector and mining corporations to pursue these kinds of underground goods. However, what we see with the mining sector too, it's an industry that produces value and produces raw materials, right, raw goods for processing and consumption elsewhere. This is the Apple iPhone, the MacBook, right, the creation of these kind of high value goods that are built from these constituent minerals, right, that are mined from the global south. And so a lot of the value and a lot of the income that is produced by the mining sector doesn't actually stay in El Salvador.
So there's another interesting story out of El Salvador that relates to mining and relates to the main river of El Salvador, which has been polluted over the years by mining. And that is that President Bukele has just signed a sort of deal with J.P. Morgan that it's going to get a kind of a debt for nature deal. It's going to reduce its international debt, and the money it makes on refinancing it, it's going to put toward cleaning and restoring the very river that the mines polluted. So what's the reaction to that?
So, I mean, it seems to me already, and from the Santa Marta community and water defenders and community defenders, that this kind of deal still, well, in theory, represents a step forward in the sense of remediating something like the Rio Lempa, which is extremely polluted already. This is a step forward, but it's still something that we've noticed already is that it's a drop in the bucket, right, to undo the damage that mining has already done in the region.
Today in the court, was it a jury that acquitted these five environmentalists?
It was a tribunal.
So isn't that significant that a tribunal in El Salvador kind of, they ruled on behalf of these defendants, on these environmentalists? Does that signal any kind of sea change in terms of process or sensibility or sort of public attitudes?
See, I think one of the things that was also on trial during the process of the Santa Marta Five was actually to see if the judicial branch of the Salvadoran government still had any integrity left. And what we did see because of the positive outcome is that there seems to be still some level of a rule of law. And the tribunal has shown us this, right? Because at the beginning, when we were observing the trial, we realized that two out of the three members of the tribunal were actually Bukele appointees. And so it was very worrisome for a lot of us, because it was clear that, or it seemed to be rather, that the outcome was sort of pre-decided in some kind of way. And so for us, this is an incredible surprise that it's gone in this direction. And we were very, very happy about this. And I think it might actually be the start of a shift, in the sense that social movements will not go quietly. And environmental defenders and community defenders who are on the front lines of defending their communities and the resources that sustain them can still utilize the courts in order to fight these kinds of transnational interests and the needs of the government.
Jorge Cuellar teaches Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College.
There is about to be a new champion in one of the world's most popular sports, cricket. The Women's T20 Cricket World Cup has been going on for the past couple of weeks. T20 is essentially a shorter version of the game. The final is set for Sunday. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on who's still in contention.
The 2024 Women's T20 Cricket World Cup was supposed to be held in Bangladesh, but in the months before the first match, weeks of anti-government protests rocked the country, and its long-serving Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, resigned. A number of countries set to play in the tournament then issued travel advisories for Bangladesh. That sent organizers, the International Cricket Council, into a bit of a scramble. They had to find a new host, fast.
The highly anticipated ninth edition of the tournament will now take place in the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE offered venues in both Dubai and Sharjah. And thus, a couple of weeks ago, the show went on.
Up in the air again. Rabia again. Can she take it this time? She can.
Despite the situation at home, Bangladesh snagged an expected but still convincing win against Scotland in the first game. As the tournament got underway, the team predicted to win it all was Australia.
When we think of women's cricket, we think of the Australian team.
You have to say Australia are the biggest challenges for everyone.
This has been one of the greatest cricket teams to have ever played, period, irrespective of gender.
Australia's team is not only the defending champions, but they've won the last three T20 World Cups and snagged the trophy a total of six times across all eight editions.
It's a sort of an overwhelming dominance to the extent that we don't really see very often in global sport.
Raf Nicholson is a sports historian and senior lecturer at Bournemouth University in southern England. She says the Aussies have been able to foster such a deep bench of talent, in large part because they were the first country to seriously invest in the women's game.
In order to have a strong national team, you have to have a really good structure underneath that kind of underpins that. And so Australia have got that. So they launched their women's domestic T20 franchise competition in 2015, the Women's Big Bash League.
That was the world's first domestic T20 cricket league for women. Since then, they've been the team to beat, which makes what happened yesterday so surprising.
Up to the leg side it goes. They're looking to win. And South Africa have reached Fortress Australia.
South Africa's Proteas beat Australia by 8 wickets in the semi-finals, earning themselves a chance at the trophy and sending Australia packing. Raf Nicholson calls the upset a massive shock.
You kind of go, hang on a minute, what's happening here? And it was the kind of ease with which they did it as well. You just felt like South Africa were in control and Australia didn't quite know where to look or where to go.
Australia was without their captain, who was injured, and South Africa, already a good team, could be seeing the benefits from hosting the last edition of the T20 World Cup. Nicholson was there back in 2020.
When we arrived, nobody really knew very much about what was happening, but South Africa then got to the final and suddenly, you know, everyone was aware. Women's cricket, it's a World Cup, we have a really successful national team. And it felt like it kind of transformed the public consciousness around women's cricket.
Unfortunately, Nicholson adds, Bangladesh likely won't see that same bump this year since they are no longer physically hosting the tournament. Australia isn't the only side heading home disappointed, though.
That could be straight out his out as well.
Despite a strong showing in their first few games, India got knocked out in the group stage. And England, another top team, lost their shot earlier this week.
And that is a vital win for the West Indies. The first time they've defeated England since 2018 in the Caribbean.
With that, the three favorites are out of the running. Nonetheless, a 25,000-person stadium is ready for Sunday's final in Dubai, where South Africa will take on New Zealand at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And now for a few things you might have missed. The city of Prague is cracking down on drunken antics, but only at night. The Czech capital has banned nighttime pub crawls to rein in the tourist groups that have caused a lot of late-night noise, garbage in the streets, and security and reputational concerns.
And in New Zealand, Defense Minister Judith Collins has urged her country's public to be better. That's after days of comments she called vile and misogynistic about the woman captain of a Navy ship that ran aground and sank in Samoa last week. Collins assured the public that the accident had nothing to do with the captain's gender. Seriously, it's 2024, Collins said.
Meanwhile, a wild cat, native to Africa and Asia, turned up in a Chicago suburb this week. Authorities lassoed the unwitting creature, who was hiding under the deck of a house. The homeowner told a local television station that the cat had been up on the deck earlier and looked right at her through the window. It would have been a startling sight. The reddish-brown nocturnal predator has muscular legs, big sharp teeth, and its ears are long and pointy. It's unclear how it came to be on the loose in suburban USA.
And there you have it, a few things you might have missed. The FBI has announced criminal charges against an Olympic snowboarder from Canada. 43-year-old Ryan James Wedding is facing allegations of cocaine trafficking and orchestrating several murders. At a news conference on Thursday in Los Angeles, U.S. Attorney Martin Estrada said the former Olympian's career took a turn after the 2002 Games in Salt Lake City.
Instead of using the privileges that come with being an Olympic athlete to do good for people, he did the opposite. He chose to become a major drug trafficker, and he chose to become a killer.
Estrada described Ryan Wedding as an athlete turned drug lord. Frederic Plon is covering the story for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. He started by telling us more about the charges against Ryan Wedding.
He was charged with several felonies, including counts of conspiracy to distribute cocaine, to export cocaine, and also three counts of murder and one count of attempt to commit murder, all in connection with drug trafficking of cocaine between Colombia, Mexico, southern U.S., and Canada.
Yeah, apparently there was a second man, Andrew Clark, another Canadian citizen living in Mexico. One of his aliases was The Dictator, and apparently he was arrested on October 8th by Mexican police and is in custody. Any accomplices that authorities are going after as well, or is it just Ryan Wedding who's at large at this point that they're after?
So according to U.S. authorities, Wedding is the only fugitive. He's part of a case with 15 other defendants, but most of the other ones have been arrested in the previous month, according to the Department of Justice.
They're pretty serious charges from the FBI. Did Wedding have a criminal history prior to this?
He did. As early as 2008, he was sentenced near San Diego to 4 years in prison for, again, drug trafficking, cocaine trafficking charges. He was also charged in 2015 in Canada when he was living in Montreal for other cocaine trafficking charges, conspiracies to traffic cocaine from Colombia to Newfoundland and to Montreal.
So Newfoundland, that's in the Far East Maritimes. Was that by boat or by plane?
Yeah, they were planning to use fishing vessels to get the drugs from Colombia to Newfoundland and then load it onto trucks to Montreal. He's still facing today, actually. The arrest warrant is still out there. We should say Mr. Wedding is a fugitive right now.
Do officials know where he is?
According to Estrada, he is probably somewhere in Mexico right now.
Do the charges against him, do they suggest that he was working with cartels or that he was his own kind of cartel, own kind of drug kingpin?
He was certainly at the head of a significant operation. The U.S. authorities talk about hundreds of kilograms of cocaine. The 2015 charges for a conspiracy to traffic cocaine talked about quantities of 10,000 kilograms. According to Estrada, he was protected by the infamous Sinaloa cartel in Mexico.
You mentioned that he was charged and sentenced in 2008 in San Diego. Did he serve any time?
Yes, he served some years. We learned in bankruptcy papers from British Columbia filed in 2014 that he was saying that he faced financial difficulties because he has served several years in prison and was unable to work at the time.
Now, Wedding is also being charged in connection with a few murders. What details do we know about that?
Yeah, he was charged with 3 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. And those murders were all connected to the drug trafficking, but also 2 of the murders were cases of mistaken identity. In November 2023, Wedding and a co-conspirator allegedly directed the murders of 2 members of an Ontario family who were complete innocents because they were mistakenly taken for someone who had stolen a drug shipment that passed through Southern California, according to U.S. authorities. They also severely injured the daughter of the couple. Those are 2 of the alleged murders.
Now, tell us about Wedding's Olympic career. What is he known for in Canada?
I wouldn't say he is very well known in Canada. He participated in the 2002 Olympics. He placed 24th at Parallel Giant Olympic Slalom. It's a race between 2 snowboarders who go downhill around gates as fast as possible. And seems to be his only Olympic Games.
And that was in 2002 when the Winter Games were in Salt Lake City?
Correct.
What do we know about his background in terms of sort of pre-Olympic life? I mean, his, you know, family life, or, you know, was he kind of an upstanding guy before all of this fell apart after the Olympics?
He was born in Thunder Bay, Ontario. According to his Olympics Canada profile, he lived for a while in British Columbia, and then he gave an address in Montreal when he was charged in 2015. Other than that, we don't know much apart from what his former teammate, Dom Silvestre, said, that he was a pleasant guy to hang out with and a good competitor.
Does Ryan Wedding have relatives in Canada, and have they said anything?
He has a wife, or had a wife. I don't know if they're still together. We have not been able to talk to his wife. I don't know if others have tried. I focused on his former teammates from the 2002 Olympics and other snowboarders. I only spoke to Sylvestre, who didn't know him that well.
Frédéric Blanc writes for the Globe and Mail. He's in Montreal.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The news from the Korean Peninsula this week is another reminder that the Korean War, after all these years, has never fully been resolved.
A carefully choreographed series of explosions near the Korean border has tensions escalating between the North and the South.
Well, dramatic video shows the moment that North Korea demolished 2 road and railways, routes that used to link the 2 Koreas.
It's a powerful message when you demolish roads, railways, you know, there's no clearer message than that.
Reporting there about the destruction of some of the last physical links between North and South Korea. The 2 countries are still technically at war, even after an armistice was reached 71 years ago. And what remains is the so-called demilitarized zone dividing the 2 Koreas. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek walked along part of the DMZ this summer and is here to talk with us. Again, Paul, great to have you back.
Always fun to be back on the show.
So, Paul, I did not realize that part of the DMZ, as it's called, is actually a waterway, the Han River, which you walked along for 3 days this summer. What struck you during that part of the walk along the Han River?
Well, like you, I wasn't aware of it until I started doing a little research. I thought, you know, it was all a land border. But the Han River is one of the major rivers in Korea. It leads upstream to the South Korean capital of Seoul. So it's always been very strategic. And where we kind of met it on foot, it's, you know, up to 2 kilometers wide, with the hills of North Korea kind of shining green on the north side. So we followed this waterway for about 40 miles.
And you write that it was strikingly pristine because no humans had been there for many, many years.
Yeah, a lot has been written about how the DMZ has been kind of rewilded for 70 plus years. Since it came into being back in 1953, people are not allowed generally to go in there, you know, so it's kind of gone back to nature. it's become this kind of very strange kind of war zone ecological preserve. And scientists say that it harbors up to 6,000 species of wildlife, including 100 endangered species. There are crane in there. There are bears in there. There are martens. There are eagles. In our walk along the watery part of it, we saw black-faced spoonbills, an endangered water bird. We saw water deer. We saw flocks of seabirds. It's quite amazing.
The name of the zone itself is a bit ironic. It's called the Demilitarized Zone, but there are well over a million troops stationed along the border. How much did you feel that intense military presence as you walked along DMZ?
You know, Caroline, to be honest, I was expecting more people. You know, from what I'd read and what I'd seen in movies, I thought there'd be, you know, a lot of military personnel kind of peering at each other with binoculars or what have you.
Sure, yeah.
But it wasn't the case, at least on this stretch that we walked. You know, in the course of 2.5 to 3 days of walking, we passed one truck with, you know, some young South Korean recruits in it. And then we went through one checkpoint where there's some young soldiers with weapons. And that was it.
Mm.
Otherwise, it was pretty quiet. Again, almost like walking on a nature trail, albeit next to bunkers and tank traps.
Interesting juxtaposition there, the pristine nature and the tank traps and bunkers.
Right. And by the way, soldiers, mannequins of soldiers in uniform.
Huh.
So they put dummies up in some of the, you know, some of these positions.
You also wrote, just a quick kind of aside in your post about this portion of your journey, that there are buttons on the fences on the South Korean side that North Korean defectors can push to summon help. I assume if they've, you know, crossed the no man's land and are about to enter South Korea. Can you tell me any more about how those work?
Yeah, it was a surprise. So we're walking along this kind of embankment, and there are these signs in Korean. And I said, what do they say? They're facing the north side. They're not facing our side. And my walking partners read them and said, well, these are kind of welcome signs to any defectors who have the strength and the wherewithal to swim this river, right? We're talking a little over a mile, pretty stiff current. It's a big river. If they make it up onto the South Korean embankment, they presumably walk to where these signs are, and there's a big button there that they can mash, and it sets off some sort of notice so that South Korean military officials would come and open a door and welcome them with water and food.
Wow. Do you know how many defectors cross that border every year?
Not many, because in recent years, the North has really cracked down security on their side. Although in South Korea right now, I'm told there are about 30,000 or so North Korean defectors living.
One of the big points of your Out of Eden walk that has you walking along the journey of human migration is that you get to stop and talk to the people you meet along the way. You wrote about an 85-year-old woman, a retired farmer, who lived within sight of the DMZ. How did she feel about living so close to, you know, a nuclear-armed enemy?
You know, I'd never been to South Korea before this walk, so I had the typical kind of vague associations and stereotypes, you know, K-pop culture, you know, the lights of Seoul City, you know, very successful, booming economy, very innovative people. And on this tiny little hamlet adjacent to the DMZ, again, along the river, here was this octogenarian woman who was crouched under a crabapple tree, hand washing her laundry using well water. It was like stepping back in time. Most of her hamlet was depopulated because there have been the same rural to urban migration, the exodus from the countryside to the capital that I saw, you know, in China.
Mm.
We asked her, how's it, you know, living next to here? And she kind of looked over her shoulder and said, I don't know. I never think about it anymore. I've been here most of my life and I'm just kind of a farmer. Yeah, she was not fazed at all.
Do people talk at all about reunification anymore? Is that something in the South Korean mind?
You know, this is something that also was a bit new to me. So I always had this kind of imagining that here are these sister countries who are kind of like circling each other, daggers drawn, one of them nuclear armed, the North, and desperate at some point to kind of get back together to become a whole Korea again. But what I quickly discovered, Carolyn, and it was a surprise to me, is that especially among the younger generation, when I would ask them about these geopolitical issues, about, you know, your neighbor to the North, people just shrugged. Younger people had other things on their mind. They tried to make a living. They might be, you know, it's a very hyper-competitive economy. almost like they had to stop and think, oh, North Korea, yeah, that country over there. They did not think of it as part of the former unified Korea. I think too much time had passed is what my Korean friends have told me.
Mm-hmm.
And fewer people believe in reunification.
What about the potential for renewed violence between the two countries? There are these flares, like Kim Jong-un this week blowing up the roads and railway links to the south. That was just the latest example.
You know, the potential is there, but the sense that I got is that not too many South Koreans that I met had that kind of lingering at the forefront of their mind these days. It seemed almost like foreigners were more concerned about it than the South Koreans themselves that I met.
We have some pictures and links to stories Paul has posted from South Korea. They're at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Carolyn. Always a pleasure to check in.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast player so you never miss a show. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Patchwork Collective, Lillianne and Ed Schneider, the Gruber Family Foundation, and the Lucy and Ken Lehman Family. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.